Call this meeting together for the Board of County Commissioners and pass it off to Mayor Sandoval.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us here. I will call the City Council portion of this joint meeting to order.
All right, and we'll pass it off to Sheila Westerman.
Good afternoon. I'm Sheila Westerman. I'd like to call the meeting of the Board of Health to order, and I'd like to make a small presentation about the Board of Health. I'm currently chair of the Jefferson County Board of Health. Since there may be many folks out in our county that are unfamiliar with county boards of health, I would like to give them a little background. Specifically, Board of Health were comprised of county commissioners only. The state legislature allowed counties to expand their boards around 1997. The time was to depoliticize public health and environmental health decisions, which can be very controversial, such as needle exchange programs or on-site septic regulations. The other reason to expand the board was to provide broader community-wide representation. County health boards now include representation from hospitals and cities, as well as the general public. I was appointed to this board in 1997. As a representative of the Port Townsend City Council. When my council service ended, I was asked to stay on as a representative of the citizens of Port Townsend and Jefferson County. I would like to acknowledge other members of the Board of Health and allow them to introduce themselves. Case, are you here?
David Sullivan, I'm County Commissioner and a member of the Board of Health.
Is Case off with us?
Yes.
Pam? From City Council? Dennis? Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Dennis Stearns. On the Board of Health.
And you represent?
I'm a citizen at large representative.
Perfect. And of course, all three county commissioners are also on the board. All of us on this Board of Health are committed to protecting the health of the public and our environment. And we're all honored to serve you.
Thank you, Sheila. Now to introduce the reason for this meeting and this grand, I'm not sure if this is an unprecedented gathering of public entities, but it's pretty spectacular. We have, in Jefferson County, have been given the option to pursue a variance under the governor's orders, the stay-at-home order, to pursue the phase two, any or all of the phase two options in the governor of State Start Washington. And before we start, I want to go through a few meeting conventions since we're dealing with a lot of people here. First of all, if participants are able, it would be great. Oh, we're joined by Pam Adams now from the Board of Health and City Council. Please use video if you're able to. And if you're not speaking, if you could mute your line, it's much easier to process it. And just two or three extra lines of static create all sorts of noise for the listening public. And this is a new convention for all of us. But if we could definitely leave pregnant pauses between people and try not to step on each other's lines, communication would be much easier. As I'm chairing this meeting, for participants, if you'd like to ask a question, we'd like to, as much as possible, refrain our questions to questions of clarification and reserve discussion for the later agenda items for actual action that we're taking. But if you have a question, please raise your hand and I will try to call on you. If you've raised your hand and I can't see you, I'm not sure how many participants I can see, but give it 20 seconds and then you can, interject with your voice. If during the call, we've often had with large meetings like this where the sound quality deteriorates significantly if you have video going with a lot of people. So I will potentially ask you to turn off your video if your audio is coming through while you are speaking. Those are the conventions that I'd like us to try to follow. We've got a lot of information to go through today, and we're definitely, as this meeting reflects, trying to build consensus for whether or not Jefferson County should pursue this variance, and if so, what options we should pursue. So we're engaged. Oh. am I a static mute? Can everyone mute their line, please, if you're not talking?
We are already having audio issues, so it might be a good time for folks to start turning off their webcams.
I will turn off my webcam as I continue to talk right now, and I think it's really when you're speaking that it causes the problem. Does that sound better to people? Okay, so it's already having an issue. So when you're speaking, pretty quickly turn off your screen. It's appealing to start with your video on, but turn it off as quickly as you can. So there are a lot of stakeholders here, but there are a lot of stakeholders that are not represented yet, and we are going to give a chance to all of those stakeholders to be represented. So we have every intention of taking public comments, publicly written public comment from the public, as well as engaging with our other representatives around the county, such as the PD and the Port of Port Townsend, and we really want to engage with our business and nonprofit sectors as well. The fact that they are not at this meeting today is because today's meeting really to set the table for what this process looks like, where we are right now from a medical standpoint, which is the most critical element in pursuing this variance. And as soon as we're through this, we're going to engage with those stakeholders and any others that haven't identified to attempt to really build a consensus as we evaluate this path forward. So with that, I think we'll move on to Washington State plans for phase reopening, and I will pass it off to Vicki Kirkpatrick, our Director of Public Health, to walk us through where we are. Vicki? You're muted, Vicki. You're muted.
Yes, I was. Thank you. I think I'll start by saying that, much like what the governor has said all along as in his various press conference about opening up again, it really is not a switch for any local community either. It also is a dial. And the four phases, just even getting ready for each of the phases, is a dial process versus switch. And there's a lot of things that we have to do.
I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second.
Turn off the radio.
Are you listening on there?
Carolyn, can you just mute any callers that come in? Unless they can mute them all. I mean, unless we are.
They're not. Yeah, I will. They're just not making noise. I can see when they're speaking, and there's no the output. Oh, wait, here's one.
Okay. Oh, we're also joined by Mike Glenn. I will also say one more thing. We are also on KPTZ, so hello to the listeners from KPTZ, and thank you for broadcasting this on the radio. And I'll pass it off to Vicki.
Thank you. And I will go ahead and turn off my camera to make sure that perhaps the sound stays better. Like I was saying, really this is a dial rather than a switch. But what I'm going to do is take us fairly quickly through what the governor's Safe Start plan is about. And I will finish by talking about what the variances are all about and the kinds of things that we need to do in order to enter into them. So Safe Start Washington is a data-driven approach to reopen Washington and to modify physical distancing measures while minimizing the health impact of COVID-19. It's intended to reduce the risk of COVID-19 to Washington's most vulnerable populations and to preserve capacity in our healthcare system while safely opening up businesses and resuming gatherings, travel, shopping, and recreation. The plan involves assessing COVID-19 activity in the state, along with healthcare system readiness, testing capacity and availability, case and contact investigations, and the ability to protect high-risk populations, which Dr. Locke and Mike Glenn of Jefferson Healthcare will speak to in the next agenda item. So what are the key requirements of the plan? First of all, is the COVID-19 disease activity before reopening and modifying physical distancing measures. COVID-19 disease burden must be low and it must be decreasing. The second key requirement is readiness and capabilities needed. The Department of Health and local public health officials will monitor data to assess the state's readiness for safely reopening and modifying physical distancing measures. In addition to a low and decreasing disease burden, readiness must be achieved in four key areas from where we are now in the stay home, stay healthy order. From phase one to phases two, three, and four, the four key areas are healthcare system readiness, testing capacity and availability, case and contact investigations, and the ability to protect high-risk populations. Each of these four key areas include metrics that must be demonstrated before a county can proceed to the next phase. This means that each phase will have to demonstrate that they have maintained low and decreasing disease burden, plus the four key readiness areas for a minimum of 3 weeks in order to be eligible to move on to the next phase. So how does this affect individuals and businesses? The governor's plan calls for ongoing community interventions to suppress the spread of COVID-19 until there's an effective vaccine, an effective treatment, or we have herd immunity. And for those that may not know, herd immunity requires that sufficient treatment, sufficient vaccine is available to reduce or eliminate infection of those receiving the vaccine, plus sufficient people that have been infected and now have a natural immunity to the infection. These two pathways for immunity must be in a high percentage. In the case of COVID, that's estimated to be around two-thirds of the population in order to reduce the spread of the disease. At this moment, we don't know quite enough about the virus to know the level of the effectiveness of the immunity produced in response to it, nor do we know how long the immunity lasts. So until we have a vaccine, effective a treatment, or achieve herd immunity, some level of heightened protection of the health and safety of workers in essential sectors, people living and working in high-risk facilities like senior care facilities, and all other workers. We all Washingtonians, have a responsibility to protect ourselves and to protect others. Each phase, while allowing for additional services to open and return to full capacity, is grounded in the following basic practices. So these following practices apply to all individuals, and then I'll also talk about those that apply to all businesses currently in phase one and then through to each of the four phases. So guidance for individuals, all phases should continue to engage in physical distancing, staying at least 6 feet away from other people. Wear cloth face coverings in public places when not eating or drinking. Stay home when sick. Avoid others who are sick. Wash hands frequently with soap and water, and use hand sanitizer if soap and water is not available. Cover coughs and sneezes. Avoid touching eyes, nose, and mouth with unwashed hands, and disinfect surfaces and objects regularly. So throughout all four of the phases, these are the requirements of individuals. There are also requirements for all employers through the four phases. And, in all phases, employers are required to maintain the 6-foot physical distancing requirements for employees and patrons, adopt other prevention measures such as barriers to block sneezes and coughs when physical distancing is not possible for a particular job task. They're also required to provide services while limiting close interaction with patrons, provide adequate sanitation and personal hygiene for workers, vendors, and patrons, ensure employees have access to hand washing facilities so they can wash their hands frequently with soap and running water, ensure frequent cleaning and disinfection of business, particularly of high-touch surfaces, identify personal protective equipment and cloth facial coverings in accordance with the Department of Labor and Industry's requirements on facial covering and industry-specific COVID-19 standards, and provide the necessary personal protective equipment, or PPE, to all employees. They're also required to identify strategies for addressing ill employees, which should include requiring COVID-19 positive employees to stay at home while infectious and potentially restricting employees who are directly exposed to the COVID-19 positive employee. Follow cleaning guidelines to deep clean after reports of an employee with suspected or confirmed COVID-19 illness, and this could potentially involve the closure of the business until the location can be properly disinfected. They're also required to educate their employees about COVID-19 in a language they best understand, and on a case-by-case basis, as directed by federal, state, and local public health and workplace safety officials, they are required to implement other practices appropriate for specific types of businesses, such as the screening of employees for illness and exposures upon work entry, requiring non-cash transactions and other similar kinds of activities. They're required to follow the requirement in Governor Inslee's Proclamation 20-46 regarding high-risk employees and workers' rights. They're required to keep a safe and healthy facility in accordance with state and federal law and comply with COVID-19 worksite-specific safety practices. Both Challenge Seattle and Washington Roundtable have developed a business checklist, which is a great starting point for businesses as they prepare for Safe Start. The shared goal is to establish clear requirements that everyone can understand and apply, employers, workers, and customers. Businesses are also expected to implement any additional requirements developed specifically for their industry, such as those that have been established for construction. So where are we now? Pardon?
Please enter.
Where are we now and how do we move through the phases? And phase one actually began on May 5th, so we're really only our third day into it. When COVID-19 disease burden is low and decreasing, and the four previously mentioned key capabilities are met, the governor will issue an order for the state to move into future phases. The state will stay in every phase for a minimum of 3 weeks to allow one complete disease incubation period plus an additional week to compile complete data and confirm trends. During that time, the Department of Health and the governor will reevaluate the indicators and determine if the state should remain in the current phase, advance to the next phase, or return to the previous phase. We are in phase one, and there are four total phases. This phased approach may be adjusted as the pandemic evolves. There's a table in the governor's plan providing information and examples of businesses and industries that are allowed in each phase. Those listed are not an exclusive or an exhaustive list. However, businesses listed will have industry-specific guidance and safety criteria developed to ensure workplace safety and public health are maintained. Those businesses are not authorized to open until the industry-specific guidance and safety criteria are issued. A number of factors were considered when deciding which activities could be resumed and which businesses could be reopened in various phases, including the risk of disease spread during an individual or business activity, the number of people who could potentially be infected during the individual or business activity, the economic benefits to opening the business, and the individual benefits to opening the business. Additional plans for a phased approach to restarting healthcare and educational activities are currently under development. Washington's phased approach. Each phase identifies, and these are in the table, each phase identifies requirements for the high-risk population, for recreation, for gatherings, for travel, and for business and employer. So now coming to the variants. The Department of Health recognizes that there are some small counties with a population of less than 75,000 that have not identified a resident with COVID-19 for the past 3 weeks. These counties have the opportunity to apply for a variance to move to phase two and before the rest of the state. To apply for the variance, the local jurisdiction must follow a defined process and submit specific documents to the Department of Health, where the Secretary of Health will approve or deny the application. So, the process must adhere to the following steps. The local public health officer must submit a signed recommendation to the local board of health with one of the following.
Sorry, those are new callers.
With one of the following recommendations: not request a variance and stay in phase one, request a variance to include all of the phase two modifications above, or request a variance to include a subset of the phase two modifications. The local board of health, if they choose to move forward with a variance request, must vote on such a request. The local hospital must submit a letter certifying that they have adequate bed capacity to serve their community and adequate PPE or personal protective equipment supplies to keep their workers safe. And the county commissioners must request to move to phase two or a subset of phase two of the plan. The county commissioner must submit a letter requesting a variance. The letter from the local hospital certifying that they have adequate bed capacity to serve their community and adequate PPE supplies to keep their workers safe, and a document that includes the following information to the Department of Plans to make COVID-19 testing available and accessible to everyone in the county with symptoms consistent with COVID-19, the number of tests performed by week over the past 3 weeks, the number of people trained and ready to perform case investigations and contact tracing, and plans to house people in isolation or quarantine who do not have a home or wish to isolate or quarantine themselves outside of their home, plans to provide case management services to cases and contacts in isolation and quarantine, and finally plans to rapidly respond to outbreaks in congregate settings. So that is what Jefferson County, these county variance requests, the process and all of these requirements must be in place before any variance request can be submitted to the State Department of Health for approval.
Thank you very much,
Mickey.
So
that's all I have.
Thank you. Does anyone have any clarifying questions for Vicki today?
This is Kate Keene. I think it's worth noting for the benefit of the Board of Health and City Council that seven counties have submitted their applications for variance so far as of today, six of whom were on the list of 10 originally, and Mason County, our neighbor to the south, was not on the list but has preemptively submitted their application to the Department of Health. And Secretary Weissman indicated that he would be reviewing those at the beginning of next week. Just an FYI.
Well, I have a question for Vicki or Dr. Locke. I guess I understand we're in phase one now, but Vicki, did you say that even the businesses in phase one need to wait for direction, so a car wash needs to wait for direction on safe standards to open, or can a car wash open today?
Specifically, the businesses listed, according to the governor's plan, will receive guidance, and they're not to open prior to the receipt of that guidance. And in conversation with the Secretary of Health, they are currently working on getting the phase one guidance out as quickly as possible. They hope to get it out this week, and then they will move on to the phase two guidance. Now, some businesses may not be specific to a particular industry, and that guidance would then need to be, we would need to look at how we might provide that guidance locally. However, the guidance that is generically listed in the governor's plan is a requirement for all businesses regardless. So, but specifically the governor's plan say that the businesses listed in those various phases will have guidance provided and cannot open until that guidance is available to them.
Yes, Dr. Long.
Yeah, maybe I can add to that. I checked this afternoon, and specifically the car wash guidance is not yet available. So technically they would not be allowed to open yet. And I also checked the The DOH's timeline for phase two guidance is May 15th. So they hope to have them done by then, but they really have to, as Vicki said, they have not yet completed phase one.
So to add to that, the earliest a phase two business could open is when they receive that specific guidance.
Correct.
May is the earliest. And my other kind of follow-up question is, since phase one allows for limited non-essential travel for phase one permissible activities, it is okay that people come from anywhere as long as they can make it back home and go fishing or go to a car wash when it's open under phase one. Is that correct interpretation of the governor's order?
The travel specifically says essential travel for phase one, says essential travel and limited non-essential travel for phase one permissible activities. Right. And it doesn't appear to restrict it to your home county.
Correct. So you could come to Jefferson County to wash your car or to buy an RV or a boat or anything else that's on that list.
Yeah, Case, did you have a question? All right. Are there any other questions regarding Vicki's presentation? All right. Well, we're moving right along. We'll pass it on to Dr. Locke to talk about Jefferson County's current status in the community. And then when you're done, Dr. Locke, we'll hand it over to Mike Glynn, CEO of Jefferson Healthcare, and as much as possible, reserve questions until after you guys have both had a chance to talk.
Okay. Well, it looks like we have five metrics to cover, and three of them are sort of public health and two are medical care. Does it sound okay with you, Mike? I'll cover the first one on disease activity, and then you can address health system readiness and testing capacity, and then I'll come back and do the other two?
Yeah, you bet.
Okay. So, well, starting out then, the first metric that we're looking at in terms of the current status is disease activity. Probably the most important, since we're in a pandemic response. And we rate that as a low to medium risk. Our current status is there have been 954 tests that have been done and returned to Jefferson County. And of those, 28 were positive, 2.9%. And the last one was exactly 4 weeks ago. Was on April 9th. We've had no confirmed cases for the last 4 weeks. But this is a very fragile kind of status that we're in that we are learning more and more about this virus, and we know that it can be transmitted by asymptomatic cases or people before they develop symptoms, and that we are only 56 miles away from the most population dense area and the epicenter for the COVID-19 outbreak in Washington State. So this status could literally change day by day. But the news is basically good so far. We have successfully flattened the curve in Jefferson County and statewide, it's flattening as well. So we're in a much better position than we were a month ago. And then I'll turn it over to Mike for healthcare system readiness and testing capacity and availability.
Well, sure. Thanks, Tom. I think relative to this application, the governor's office is defining readiness of the healthcare system in two ways. One is our ability to for a COVID surge, and then the second is adequate PPE. And I think objectively, the answer to both those questions is yes, we do. When we were anticipating perhaps a greater and quicker surge of inpatient COVID activity, we developed this three-tiered bed expansion plan that allows us to get up to 60 inpatient beds under the roof of the hospital. And we were exploring agreements with the local post-acute care centers to either lease beds post-acutely or a more streamlined discharge and admission process. So we were thinking that up to 75 patients requiring some level of care, we could take care of locally. And most of the modeling we did suggested that would be sufficient. We also have explored how we would staff all of those beds, and because some of these innovative new beds would be in units as opposed to private rooms, that the staffing is far more efficient that way. Where not only can one nurse take care of more patients, but it's a more efficient use of PPE as well. So I think we're in good shape there. The second component is adequate levels of PPE to keep staff safe. We've established a exclusive for COVID surge use PPE inventory that would cover 21 days of anticipated high COVID patient volumes and high emergency room volumes. So I think the state's definition of adequate PPE is like 7 days, which frankly I don't think is any hospital administrators or any bedside nurses' definition of adequate PPE. But for the purpose of this application, I think the answer to that question is yes. We plan to hold a special board meeting Tuesday, the 12th, where I will speak to I along with our provider leadership team of Dr. Mattern, Butterfield, and Tracy Harris will speak to these issues to the board, readiness and bed expansion and PPE availability objectively, and also offer any subjective comments about the situation. With respect to testing, we're in a pretty good place right now. The supply pipeline for the testing swabs that you send out to the University of Washington has kind of broken loose a little bit, so we have plenty of the test kits to take here and then send out to the U. And we're getting turnaround times between 24 and 36 hours now. So that's a pretty safe and reliable resource. But we are testing in our COVID clinic. We are testing in our drive-through clinic. Our drive-through station, and we also have equipped most of our clinics for COVID testing if the provider thinks that's appropriate. And we also, about a week ago, we turned on-site testing capabilities so we can turn a test around at the Jefferson Healthcare Laboratory in about an hour. That test swab is very difficult to get. We had an original order of 180 of the kits come in. We had to use 30 to validate our system because we've never used it for this purpose before. And in the last week or so, we've used about another 50. So we only use those for ruling out a COVID patient prior to an emergency surgery or if a symptomatic patient is admitted upstairs and the provider believes they need to get a quick rule out. But once that supply chain breaks loose, I think we will be in really, really good shape with respect to testing. And starting this week, we're actually bumping up our testing numbers to about 50 a day. We are testing more patients pre-surgical or pre-dental starting next week, and some other higher risk procedures. I think that concludes my comments.
Okay, great. So I'll move on to the third or the fourth metric, which is our capability to do case and contact investigations. And that's something where we really have expanded our capability dramatically in the last 2 months. And so we certainly meet the standards there. We currently have 7 trained and highly experienced case and contact investigators, and we're training 2 more. And significantly, these are all full-time county employees, as opposed to volunteers. Some counties have had to rely heavily on volunteers, which is a group that's harder to call on weekends and overtime after hours, which is how you have to do case and contact investigations. Very time intensive. You have to do it as soon as you get the results. We have had several retired public health professionals in the area have volunteered to serve as investigators, so we will train them if the need arises. And then, in addition, the Department of Health is in the process of setting up a large, somewhere between 900 and 1,200 investigators, mostly National Guard members, who will be kind of a backup state system. And what we're most interested in from the state is the strike teams, as they're calling them, that can come in and investigate long-term care facility outbreaks. If we're ever faced with that situation, we likely would call on the state resources just because of their greater expertise in that area. On the issue of isolation and quarantine facilities, we have limited capacity locally that so far we have not had to use. But we do have plans in place. There is excess capacity in our neighboring counties of Kitsap and Clallam that we could potentially use if we exceeded what's available in Jefferson County. And then the final metric is risk to vulnerable patients, and by the vulnerable mostly means people who are at risk of complications. So people who are over the age of 65 and people with chronic medical conditions that put them at increased risk. And there, this is where Jefferson County is very high risk, as the oldest county age-wise in Washington State. I looked up our latest census projections effective July of this year. It's that we will have 36.9% of Jefferson County residents will be over the age of 65. So this is highest in the state, and this contrasts to the statewide level of 15.4%, or neighboring King County or nearby King County is 13.2%. So we are anywhere from 2 to 3 times what other counties in the state are, and age is the main risk factor for complications with COVID-19. Of all the feedback and emails I have gotten from the public so far regarding variance requests, this appears to be the area of greatest concern, and especially as it links to tourism and the risk of importing infection and then exposing these vulnerable seniors that are a substantial portion of our population. So this is a very real concern for Jefferson County. And then those are the 5 metrics.
Great. Thank you both very much. Does anyone have any questions for either Mike Glenn or Dr. Love? Yes, Michelle? Or Michelle David?
Thank you, Greg. So actually, I had a question about the testing capability. On the EOC call sometime recently, there was a conversation about the need to get up to 100, potential ability to get up to 100 tests a day. That was the goal. And so if we're at 50, how long will that take to get to the 100 a day?
Well, I'm going to let Tom answer that because that was the goal Tom set for us.
Okay.
I expect there are science behind it.
Okay.
And that in retrospect was a somewhat arbitrary goal, but I actually think 50 is a very reasonable target. And just recently, since that conversation several weeks ago, a national modeling agency has come up with a surveillance per population unit that would work out to about 60 tests a day for Jefferson County. They were recommending 179 per 100,000 population. So if we adjusted for our population, it would be right around 60. So we are definitely in the ballpark at 50 a day.
Thank you. That's good to hear.
David, you had a question?
Yes. Regarding the protective equipment, I want to make sure that our healthcare workers have enough. Will the hospital be evaluating the standard and, if it's inadequate, recommending a higher standard? And also I'm concerned about having enough of this equipment for everybody else, too.
I'm not sure I understood the first part of your question, David. Evaluating the standard of how and when to use what type of PPE?
And whether you have enough for, you mentioned that the amount that you had for hospital employees might not be as much as you'd like, and that you're going to be having discussions with the staff and hospital board about that.
No, if I said that, I misspoke. What I intended to say is that the state, for the purpose of this application, it has identified 7 days of PPE as adequate, and I don't think that's an adequate amount because particularly at a place like Jefferson Healthcare, the patient census can go from 5 patients to 20 patients over a weekend, and your use skyrockets. We are putting together two separate inventories. One inventory is strictly for this COVID patient surge, which frankly we hope we never see. But we wanted to make sure that we wouldn't ever be caught without. So we have in effect 21 days of N95 procedure masks and gowns at a use rate projected of 20 COVID patients and 5 non-COVID patients at a very busy emergency department. So that's one inventory. Then we have our non-COVID patient care PPE inventory that we are also building up to take care of the growing pent-up demand of care that we have been unable to provide over the last couple of weeks. And that is we are treating it like a separate inventory. But I will take this opportunity to make a plea to Willie and the EOC that the state has tons of PPE on order and expecting to begin to filter in, and that's been a pipeline that really hasn't been available to us in big numbers. We have had to find PPE our conventional ways, which pits us against other hospitals and our state against other states. So I think I would encourage Willie to continue doing that great work of trying to open up that pipeline with the state, because this probably is, although we're in a pretty good place right now, if there is another statewide surge, the demand for PPE will go through the roof, and it will be a concern for all bedside caregivers, hospital administrators, and community members.
Great, thank you. Sheila, yes, go ahead.
Mr. Glenn, I'm wondering, are we performing now non-emergency procedures at the hospital, and are you ramping that up?
We are. The governor issued a interpretive guidelines on what precisely he meant when he canceled elective procedures, because there was a lot of confusion, and because of the criminal penalty attached to violating that proclamation, hospitals and surgeons were loath to venture out from what they thought they understood. And last week he issued a interpretive guideline that now allows for necessary semi-urgent procedures that really, if they're not done, the patient's quality of life will continue to have to be on pain medication that isn't good for them, and a host of other specific factors that if a physician in his or her clinical judgment believes the care is justified, that we will take care of that patient. So part of the answer to your question is yes, we are taking care of more of these patients that have necessary surgical needs, but maybe not in the classic emergency sense. But more importantly, with our elderly population, there's just a lot of patients that have suffered from multiple chronic diseases and that are used to coming to seeing our primary care clinics a couple of times a month. And we pivoted to telemedicine, and I think that was helpful and certainly better than nothing. But for some patients, it's not adequate. So we are beginning to see more of those patients, and as a result, there is a lift in patient care activity at the hospital, which is why we are establishing really kind of two separate PPE inventories, because we don't want to be using a PPE today on a non-COVID patient that we may think we would need for a COVID patient next month.
So as a follow-up to that, so regarding your bed expansion that you've developed, if we had a surge, would you be able to keep those people that you're going to start serving again separate from the COVID-19 patients that would come in if we were to experience a surge? I mean, take it into account.
Yeah, we would stop. We would stop seeing those patients. Just like what hospitals across the state proved amazingly capable at doing is shutting down their business. When the governor issued his proclamation, I think we overinterpreted it, and we basically stopped seeing anything that wasn't emergent. So we developed a skill set to do that real fast, and just in terms of, we've got several triggers for that. Some of those triggers will be just an increasing prevalence of disease in the community, which is another reason why testing is important. Another trigger will be if that non-COVID patient PPE inventory dips down to about 7 days, then that would be an indicator to us that either the PPE supply lines have slammed shut again, or that we were beginning to see more COVID patients that require more PPE. So it's kind of a complex formula, But the good news is that all of these decisions are being led by doctors Mattern, Butterfield, and Harris, and we're trying to be pretty thoughtful about being in a place to take care of these COVID patients that we haven't seen any yet, while at the same time taking care of patients who are suffering from either surgical issues or medical issues that truly need care right now.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Yes, Pam, go ahead.
Thanks. Mike, this is a question that's sort of a follow-up of what we've been talking about now, is when a resident wants to get tested, what would be the process? Would they call their primary care physician first and talk about their symptoms? What would be the process for a resident to be able to get tested?
Well, they could call their primary care physician, and then their primary care physician would either transfer their call or encourage them to call our COVID 1-800 hotline. And that line is answered by a COVID nurse consultant that will take them through sort of a series of questions and determine if they meet testing criteria. And if they are symptomatic, that would result in an appointment the next day at the COVID clinic, where they would see a provider and then be tested. If they're not symptomatic, but have had in the past exposure to a COVID patient, we would encourage them to go through the drive-through. Now that we are intentionally increasing testing, and that the criteria for what green lights a COVID test has been relaxed, pretty much anybody who calls that COVID line now, if they don't need to be seen at the clinic, we are encouraging them and giving them an appointment for the drive-through station.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's answers my question. Then I have one quickie for Dr. Locke. Many people have been using that temperature screening, it sounds like something that would be happening if we opened some new businesses, et cetera. Is that a real indication of infection? Is that really something that you can count on as an indicator, taking a temperature?
It actually is. In fact, it's one of the best signs of differentiating infection from other causes of respiratory symptoms like cough and sneeze and sore throat. And many of those kinds of symptoms can be caused by things other than infections. Mm-hmm. You know, sore throat can be caused by heartburn. But fever is unique to infection, and that number 100.4 comes from studies that say the natural variation of human temperature, generally it can get up into the high 99 range, but when it gets above 100.4, which is 38 degrees Celsius, then it's much more likely to be infection than a natural variation. We strongly encourage that as a way of self-monitoring. And people who are in quarantine after exposure, that's one of the main ways we monitor them. We have them take their temperature twice a day, and if it goes up, we test them.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Kate, you had a question?
Yeah, I have a couple, actually. In looking at the instructions on variants from the Department of Health, it includes some criteria, including a plan to house people in isolation who don't have a home, the ability to provide case management, and the ability to respond to an outbreak with congregate care. Can we get an update on where we are with those three requirements as outlined by the Secretary of Health?
So I can try to answer that one. So our plan currently was in terms of housing the homeless, the immediate plan, we used some available hotel space in Port Townsend, and then moving while we were setting up a sort of a congregate care setting at the fairgrounds. So the fairgrounds ultimately will be the shelter for those without homes, both in terms of the fairground building, which has been modified, and then there's some RVs out there as well. And then we have 32 rooms available at a hotel that we can use for isolation and quarantine. And you know, conceivably, we could look for additional hotel rooms if we exceeded that. But so far, all the 28 cases, confirmed cases, they've either been hospitalized or they have, by their choice, they have recovered at home and have been taken care of by family members. So we've had no one who has a home who's requested that we provide an isolation or quarantine service for them. But it can happen. So our plan, like many counties, is to use hotels rather than to set up a freestanding unit that would have very unpredictable demand.